what's happened to his children from disease to hunger? Your final comment.
With the other reality where 9 out of 10 households in North Gaza have gone to... You have a reality where 9 of 10 households, according to the World Food Program in North Gaza, have been without food for a whole day and a whole night. Imagine families that have to spend hours or more a day just to be able to get a couple of pieces of bread to feed their family. We're seeing hundreds of bodies pile up a day in airstrikes. We risk seeing that or more in the days ahead if there isn't urgent action by world leaders to end these atrocities.
Omar Shakir of Human Rights Watch, we thank you so much for being with us. And we wrap by saying happy birthday to Renee Feltz.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
My name is Mike. I work at KBOO as the data coordinator. I'm a KBOO host. I do a little show called Pandemonium, and I am a KBOO listener. I love listening to KBOO because it doesn't sound like anything else. I wish I could take credit for that. I'd love to say the reason KBOO sounds so interesting and different is because we have the best DJs, the best reporters, the best volunteers. I believe we do. I think we have an amazing community, but I don't think that's why KBOO sounds the way that it does. KBOO sounds different because of the way we are funded. KBOO is funded by you, the listener. Everyone gets the same radio, and you contribute what you can when you decide to, and there's no advertiser interfering in the relationship between you and the programmers. They say that's not supposed to work. They've been telling KBOO that will never work for 55 years now, and you, the listener, keep proving them wrong. So please help make sure KBOO continues sounding different by keeping KBOO listener-sponsored, independent, and non-commercial. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift to KBOO at kboo.fm/give right now. And thank you so much.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year campaign. Help us meet our $75,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's different hues of independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Our members continue to shine a light on community radio every time they give.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's small donor elections program may not have the funds to support all of 2024's candidates. High-speed rail in the Cascadia corridor is snubbed by federal grantors. And vocational training becomes a bright spot for colleges amid enrollment declines. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 19, 2023. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland's small donor election program doesn't have enough funds to support the number of candidates running for local office in 2024. This is partially because the new form of government that Portlanders voted for in 2022 calls for 12 city councilors compared to the 4 commissioners in the current system. The program works to help candidates who only accept small donations instead of being backed by wealthy donors. If they pledge not to take donations over $350, the city matches the first 20 of every donation 9-to-1, meaning a $20 donation turns into $180 in campaign funds. But there isn't enough money in the city general fund to support this for all the candidates who would like to use it, which means shrinking the amount that each can expect to see matched. For one candidate, Angelita Murillo, that means revisiting the wage she pays her campaign manager. Murillo told OPB, quote, "This program was originally set to level the playing field for grassroots candidates like me, but now we're limited," end quote. Already 40 candidates have signed up to participate in the small donor election program. That's a lot, but it's extra inflated by a unique election year when all 12 council seats are open, plus the mayor. Leaders of the program don't see it being an ongoing problem for future elections, but it will throw a wrench into the plans of city council hopefuls this election cycle. Oregon and Washington received far less federal grant money for high-speed trains between Portland, Oregon, and Vancouver, Canada, than advocates had hoped. The State Transportation Department received a few grants of $500,000, but they were hoping for a grant around $200 million. That wouldn't have been enough to start building a high-speed rail between those cities, but it's money that's needed to get planning off the ground, according to advocates. Critics of the high-speed plan are pleased, though. They say it's an opportunity to focus on upgrades to the rail corridor between Eugene and Vancouver, Canada. In particular, they're eyeing a sharp turn near DuPont, Washington, where an Amtrak train derailed to deadly results in 2017. Enrollment has dipped at colleges and universities in recent years, but vocational and trade programs have remained steady. The workers from these programs play a key role in the economy. Eric Tagadoff has more.
While some college programs struggle to bring students back to the classroom, vocational and training programs are becoming a more important part of higher education. Lower Columbia College in Southwest Washington is looking to the legislature to fund its new Center for Vocational and Transitional Studies building in the upcoming session. The new building will house welding, fabrication, and machining. Nolan Wheeler with the college says these are critical areas of education.
Everything relies on machining. Everything in our life, right? Cars we drive, the food we eat goes through something that's been manufactured. And particularly here in Southwest Washington, manufacturing has always been a vital part of our economic success.
The estimated cost for the new building is nearly $43 million. While colleges and universities have seen a decline in enrollment, the construction trades, for instance, saw a 6.2% increase between 2020 and 2022, according to the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. Wheeler says the new building is needed for his college.
It's going to be wonderful to have updated modern space for our students, which will allow us to better serve our service district, including the local employers.
The new facility at Lower Columbia College will also include the headquarters for the college and career preparation and information technology programs. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Over 700 people participated in the first year of Oregon's legalized psilocybin therapy programs. It was passed by voters in 2022 and allows people to use psilocybin, or the psychoactive component in magic mushrooms, for treating anxiety, depression, and PTSD, among other issues. They have to do it under professional supervision, and the doses they take are grown in Oregon and tested by new state labs that all got their certifications this year. It's a new industry that started from scratch and has a lot of interest and long wait lists. One focus going forward is lowering the cost. The treatment isn't covered by medical insurers, and on the low end, it can cost $600. On the high end, it could be several thousand dollars, which causes equity problems for those who can access the treatment. It's also been attracting out-of-state interest. One provider estimated half of their clients came from outside of Oregon. Former President Trump increasingly spreads violent rhetoric. Fake 2020 electors for Trump are charged in Nevada. And a federal judge says Oregon Republicans who boycotted the state legislature can't seek re-election. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think the real number is 15, 16 million people into our country. When they do that, we got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
Former President Donald Trump tells supporters at a New Hampshire rally that undocumented immigrants are a poisonous invasion. The GOP frontrunner is increasingly praising dictators and using violent white supremacist rhetoric, repeatedly calling his political opponents vermin. President Joe Biden is joining historians who say vermin and poison were specific words used by Adolf Hitler when attacking Jews and other targets. The six Nevada Republicans who served as fake electors for Trump in 2020 pleaded not guilty Monday to state felony charges. The defendants, including state GOP Chairman Michael McDonald, continue to say the election was stolen.
I said it before. You give us a fair election, I give you the next president of the United States.
Nevada is the third state after Michigan and Georgia to file charges against people in the Trump campaign's nationally organized fake elector plan. In Wisconsin, Republican leaders say they won't remove a fellow Republican from the state's bipartisan election commission, despite him serving as a fake elector there. They defend the scheme as merely a failed legal strategy and not a sinister plot to overturn an election. But Wisconsin Secretary of State Sarah Godlawski says the commissioner and the others have admitted in court it was much more.
He put personal preference above the will of the people, and that's dangerous, and he needs to be removed.
The White House says states like Pennsylvania and Arizona selling billions in arms to Ukraine will lose those jobs unless Congress passes an aid package. And National Security Council spokesman John Kirby is repeating that the battlefield situation is getting desperate.
It's a dire situation here, not just up on Capitol Hill, but it's going to be a dire situation in the east and the south of Ukraine very, very soon.
A federal judge says Oregon state senators who staged a six-week walkout last year to boycott gun control and abortion bills can't seek re-election. The judge cited a voter-approved constitutional amendment preventing lawmakers with 10 or more unexcused absences from running again. Republican State Representative Tim Knope calls the decision a violation of their First Amendment and a misinterpretation of the law.
We're not arguing over semantics. We're arguing over the plain language of the measure, and they want it to mean something else. If they wanted it to mean something else, they should have written it to mean something else.
And the two Georgia election workers who won a nearly $150 million judgment against former Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani for defamation last week are suing him again. Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss say in spite of the verdict, Giuliani is still repeating his false accusations of voter fraud. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Department of Treasury has just issued a new application for community development financial institutions to make sure they are living up to their mission of helping underbanked businesses and homeowners. Suzanne Potter has the details.
The feds are increasing oversight on community development financial institutions, or CDFIs, making the application process more rigorous to weed out bad actors. In the past, shady financial institutions like predatory lenders have been able to get CDFI status. Andrew Kushner with the Center for Responsible Lending says he's seen CDFIs offer loans with annual percentage rates as high as 190%.
Now the CDFI rules will restrict them from offering loans over 36% APR, which we think of as the cutoff for safe and responsible loans. So you won't be seeing predatory practices from CDFIs.
President Bill Clinton signed legislation creating the CDFI Fund 30 years ago with a mission to provide home and business loans to borrowers, often women or people of color, who may not have assets to use as collateral but are still creditworthy. David Beck with Self-Help Credit Union says conventional banks reject people who don't fit into their criteria for cookie-cutter loans, while reputable CDFIs take more time to evaluate each potential borrower.
Mission-driven lenders provide access to credit to those who generally have not been able to get conventional credit in order to help families and small companies grow their economic viability.
According to the Opportunity Finance Network, a national association of CDFIs, 1,300 of these institutions manage $222 billion nationwide. 61% of their clients are people of color, and 83% qualify as low income. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during the program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be clear with a daytime high of 53. Today in history, in 1983, the original FIFA World Cup trophy, the Jules Rimet Trophy, is stolen from the headquarters of the Brazilian Football Confederation in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The quote of the day is from American protest singer Phil Ochs, who said, quote, "It's wrong to expect a reward for your struggles. The reward is the act of the struggle itself, not what you win. Even though you can't expect to defeat the absurdity of the world, you must make that attempt. That's morality. That's religion. That's art. That's life." Wisconsin's public colleges and universities have been embroiled in a debate over demands from the legislature to limit diversity efforts in exchange for more state funding. With a decision now made, advocates for students of color call for more involvement in student government associations to help their peers feel welcome. Mike Moen reports.
Campuses within Wisconsin's public university system now face hard limits on diversity and inclusion efforts following a controversial budget agreement tied to the legislature. Advocates for black and brown students hope it inspires activism. Last week, the Board of Regents approved a deal pushed by Republican lawmakers to freeze DEI hiring so that schools could receive state funding for staff raises and campus construction projects. Jesse Segarra of the Wisconsin-based group Leaders Igniting Transformation sees the outcome as a dangerous precedent. She hopes student groups will be motivated to push back.
Student government associations in Wisconsin hold a great power and privilege to speak on behalf of the students, especially with working with chancellors and administrators and the dean of students.
While policies may vary between campuses, Segarra says she's encouraging these associations to use their resources to support diversity efforts, encouraging students to attend meetings. Republican legislative leaders contend DEI programs are divisive. Their arguments come amid growing cultural debates at colleges and universities across the U.S. Segarra says diversity, equity, and inclusion programs were a tremendous help when she attended college in Wisconsin. She feels they can set students who feel they don't have a voice on a better path.
All students benefit, and especially students who come from different backgrounds, whether they come from big cities, small cities. Everyone benefits from these resources.
And researchers with Texas A&M University say their look into a specific DEI plan revealed an increase in enrollment for Latino students, among other positive benefits. However, the study also found that despite these efforts, students felt that people on campus still tended to stay within their own identity groups. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison will offer free tuition to members of the state's 11 tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Students who are enrolled members of Wisconsin's 11 federally recognized tribes will get free tuition, housing, and other educational needs at the state's largest university, UW-Madison. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM has more.
University officials say their aim is, starting next fall, to cover the full cost of pursuing an undergraduate degree for Native students who live in Wisconsin and meet tribal enrollment criteria. Tribal leaders helped develop the program and announce it at a Madison news conference. Shannon Holsey is president of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians and is chairwoman of the Great Lakes Intertribal Council. She noted that the UW campus sits on ancestral land of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
Embedded in the land we stand on today lies the legacy of the Ho-Chunk people. Today is historic and cycle-breaking.
Only about 650 of the UW-Madison's roughly 50,000 students identify to the school as American Indian or Alaska Native. Ho-Chunk President John Greendeer praises the tuition program, but says he has some work to do to get Native students to consider higher education.
Many of us are in the generation where if you went to college, you stopped learning about your ways and you stopped learning your language, and it was frowned upon. Now it's very much supported, very much needed.
Lacouture tribal member Callista Kadot is a third-year student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She encourages Native students to apply to the campus.
And be able to achieve your goals. It's not something that comes easy, but it's definitely doable.
Campus officials say donors and institutional funds will pay for the program. A pilot effort will cover in-state tuition and fees for enrolled tribal members pursuing a law or medical degree at UW-Madison. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
A conservation group says it sent more than 100 bison to tribes in Montana, South Dakota, and Washington. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
American Prairie sent 107 bison from its herd in eastern Montana to five tribes in November. 21 were sent to the Blackfeet Nation and Rocky Boy Tribe. The conservation nonprofit distributes bison to tribes every year. The Intertribal Bison Council says this helps tribes build their herds and diversify genetics. The bison are tested for brucellosis and other diseases before they are sent to tribes. American Prairie says the distribution also helps it maintain its own herd, which now stands at about 900. Restoring bison to the landscape is culturally important for tribes, which relied on the animals for centuries. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Minnesota's new state flag and seal design features the Dakota language. Last week, a state commission picked the design, which is a red-eyed loon on a lake surrounded by trees, the North Star, and wild rice. It features words in Dakota for land where the waters reflect the sky. The Star Tribune reports the current one has long drawn criticism for depicting colonization, featuring a white settler plowing a field and a Native American riding a horse into the sunset. The new design is set to become official in 2024 unless the state legislature vetoes it. The Dakota Ojibwe Tribal Council, the University of Manitoba, Disney Lucasfilm, and APTN announced Monday a partnership to create an Ojibwe version of Star Wars: A New Hope. The project is part of language revitalization efforts. Auditions for voice actors are expected to take place in Winnipeg next year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new poll commissioned by the end-of-life advocacy group Compassion and Choices finds that one quarter of voters have experienced or witnessed discrimination in healthcare. Suzanne Potter has more.
25% of voters say they have personally experienced or witnessed discrimination in healthcare due to race, ethnicity, gender, disability, religion, or sexual orientation, according to a new poll sponsored by Compassion and Choices, an end-of-life care advocacy group. The poll included more than 1,600 voters from across the U.S. Pollster Amy Simon is with Goodman Simon Strategic Research.
And it was striking that one quarter of voters report that they've personally experienced or witnessed discrimination in healthcare, with an even higher 35% among Black people, 29% among Hispanics, and 41% among people who are LGBT. That translates to millions of people who are experiencing healthcare discrimination.
Negative experiences include patients who don't feel heard or are prescribed insufficient pain medication to ease suffering. Statistics show that patients of color have significantly worse health outcomes compared with their white counterparts. Kim Callanan is president and CEO of Compassion and Choices. She says one way to reduce discrimination is to make sure high-quality palliative care is available in low-income neighborhoods, not just in wealthier areas.
Clinicians need to focus on improving their cultural intelligence so that they're able to effectively interact with people who are different from them. We also need to prioritize the recruitment of a more diverse clinician pool so that people see other people that look like them.
The survey also addressed attitudes toward end-of-life care and found that a huge majority think their end-of-life wishes will be respected, but only 37% had completed an advanced directive or living will, and only 36% said they had appointed a healthcare proxy. On its website, Compassion and Choices offers a free end-of-life decisions guide, information on advanced care planning, and a dementia values and priorities tool. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A former U.S. ambassador to Israel has called Prime Minister Netanyahu a clear and present danger to Israel. One commentator on the issue says he's right. Netanyahu's main goal is to stay in office, and his war strategy is built around that goal. That makes President Biden's efforts to restrain Israel's assault on Gaza highly unlikely to succeed. We now go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. A former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, has called for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign, saying, quote, Netanyahu's determination to stay in power, no matter the cost, is a clear and present danger to Israel. That's quite a charge, but in this case it's warranted, because when we examine the politics that helps drive the Israel-Hamas war, Netanyahu stands out for his determination to use the war to stay in power, in the process compromising Israel's and Middle East security and harming Israel's relations with the United States. Netanyahu's war strategy is shaped around his continuation in office. How he handles the hostage situation, Gaza's political future, bargaining with Hamas, and the Americans are all linked to his calculations about prospects for remaining in power. He has to juggle three basic considerations. First, support from the far-right members of his cabinet, which depends on his maintaining a hard line on the Palestinians. Second, pressure from families of the hostages to make their return his top priority. And third, his insistence on total victory over Hamas. When Netanyahu told soldiers last month of his three wartime objectives, eliminate Hamas, return all of our hostages, and ensure that Gaza will not go back to being a threat to the state of Israel, he was outlining a political map for staying in charge. He was also sending the Biden administration a message. But Netanyahu's political map is fraught with obstacles. How can he achieve total victory over Hamas and still hope to free all the hostages? How can he satisfy the Americans' insistence on limiting civilian casualties and maintain the support of the far right, who demand a fight to the finish? Politics involves difficult, sometimes impossible choices, and Netanyahu is facing just that. The end of the ceasefire is hardly surprising, but we may one day find out that it was a decision the Israeli government reached because of the demand by Netanyahu's far right cabinet to put war objectives ahead of the release of all the hostages. That is probably Netanyahu's preference, too. Being a wartime leader means putting the fight with Israeli liberals and the Biden administration over judicial reform in the background. Netanyahu's political calculations must also include expectations about how politics in the U.S. will affect Biden administration relations with Israel. Joe Biden is constrained by his longtime support of Israel, by the dominant view in Congress and the voting public that Israel's security is a high U.S. priority, and by his predecessor's unwillingness to condition U.S. aid to Israel on a humane treatment of the Palestinians. All those factors help account for Biden's refusal so far, despite all the costs, to call for a ceasefire, a position that gives Netanyahu license to press his war. Biden is embracing a hopelessly contradictory policy. He and other U.S. officials can criticize Israeli war policy all they want, call for an end to indiscriminate bombing of Gaza, for more careful targeting to avoid unnecessary civilian casualties, for stopping the ground invasion of Gaza by year's end, all while providing Tel Aviv with more weapons to keep doing those very things. Netanyahu and the far right listen and then defy. Israel is expanding the war to the south of Gaza, driving people toward the Egyptian border, and resisting setting no bombing zones. The Palestinian casualty count is now over 18,000, two-thirds women and children. Gaza is becoming virtually uninhabitable. If and when the fighting stops, this same prime minister will advocate for some form of Israeli occupation of Gaza, rejecting the Palestinian governance for years to come, rejecting responsibility for Gaza's reconstruction, and rejecting Palestinian statehood. Thomas L. Friedman of the New York Times writes of Netanyahu that he is, quote, offering only one vision right now, 7 million Jews trying to govern 5 million Palestinians in perpetuity. And that is a prescription for disaster for Israel, America, Jews everywhere, and America's moderate Arab allies. America is Israel's best friend, yet Netanyahu isn't returning the favor. With an election year approaching, Biden is operating with one hand tied behind his back when it comes to Israel. Unless he's willing to take the next steps, call for resuming the ceasefire, which, granted, will be hard to do, insist on a two-state solution, and tie further U.S. military aid to Netanyahu's compliance with U.S. terms, he will be vulnerable to criticism from the more progressive Democrats, the Muslim communities, and many young voters. And that's in addition to having to deal with a hostile UN leadership and many in Middle East governments. The latest UN Security Council vote endorsing a ceasefire found the U.S. isolated, the only member of 15 to vote against. That's not a place he wants to be or needs to be. I'm Mel Gertal for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 19, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, and Catherine Carley. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign now, so this is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Some of the proposed solutions that's coming from grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact, we're bringing you a story about how government warning systems in California's wine country failed thousands of farm and service workers who didn't speak English when the Tubbs fire broke out in 2017.
Around 4 a.m., someone came to my door